Good morning, world travelers and diners. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're continuing with our exploration of a very interesting part of this country, Southern Virginia, which was not altogether new to us, but held many, many surprises. We were there, of course, for their celebration of Virginia Wine Week, and we encountered...
It's a whole month, Virginia Wine Month, starting on the 1st of October.
Oh, I meant that. A slip of the tongue.
So we got a head start. In fact, those of you who are regular listeners will already have heard the bonus program that we put through just a few days ago. And this is a continuation with some of the continued adventures of On the Menu in Virginia. And we're going to give pride of place in this program right at the beginning to a restaurant we consider one of the great dining discoveries.
Oh yeah,
that we've made in a long time. But let me give you a clue. Let's suppose you were picking a restaurant to go to, and you wanted it to be good, and you could describe a chef's profile. Then you might well say, well, right before he found his own restaurant, he was executive sous chef and essentially in charge of the kitchen at the Inn at Little Washington, one of the top five restaurants in the world. And that's exactly what Frank was before we caught up with him in Culpeper at his own place called Foti's.
We're talking to Frank Maragos, and our co-owner and chef at the Foti's restaurant, Culpeper, Virginia. And we've been talking, and Frank has so many stories. I don't know quite where we're going to start. He has, first of all, a fabulous and interesting family history, half Greek, half German. And on the Greek side, tell us how you ended up, your family, in North Dakota.
Well, my family decided to move from Thessaloniki, Greece, in the late 20s. They came through Saskatchewan and found that North Dakota, still in the late 20s, still had the Homestead Act. And so they moved down, got grants from the government, and secured three plots, one on the North Hill, one on the South Hill, and one in the Valley, and opened up a cut-rate grocery store and butcher shop. And from that cut-rate grocery store, he would barter for all the goods, because during the Depression, he would take stuff from their gardens, chickens, things like that, and resell them, nails, paint, anything that they needed, and then resell those items to, arrange for money to come back into his store. And as the town grew, he then opened up an additional store on the North Hill, an additional store on the South Hill, and then eventually a restaurant in 1954, which is still going.
Right, and we were looking even back further to the name of your restaurant, Foti's. That is named after somebody very special. Could you tell us that connection?
Well, certainly. The name Foti derives from my Greek grandfather's best friend, who introduced him to his wife. And in essence, kind of created our family. And an important part of our culture is to keep those people who have been very special to our family alive in our family. And so the firstborn son, which is my father, would name his firstborn son Foti after the person who introduced that, in essence, then was me. And then I would give my firstborn son the same name and kind of keep his name alive in our family for generations to come.
And it's actually your firstborn is this restaurant. Now, Chef, somebody's looking at the name and thinking they're going to pick up a menu and find a Greek restaurant. They're really wrong. You've traveled all over. You said you were the vagabond. And describe a little bit about the influences on this menu and on your food.
After leaving home in the early 90s, I found that being a nomad in this business lent itself to being nothing but a vast travel of knowledge and learning. I've had great teachers along the way in Southern cuisine, Californian cuisine, to everything from West Coast to East Coast. And through those great teachers, they taught me fabulous techniques, which I held on to. Well, but growing up in half Greek and half German family, you had grandmas on both sides that were just so full of wanting to teach what they learned from their grandparents and their parents, that I take those techniques that have been ingrained in me over the years and apply them to the dishes and the styles of cooking that I've learned throughout my travels. Best way I think I can describe the food would be Mediterranean-influenced American cuisine.
But there was another major influence along the way that was before you came to open your own restaurant, a name that will be somewhat familiar to most On the Menu listeners. And that must have been a wonderful opportunity and a great help to you in creating a style that was unique?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're bringing up to date from how actually Chef got from Providence, Rhode Island to Culpeper, Virginia.
Well, I got a fabulous opportunity in my career to work at probably one of the greatest kitchens that has, one, ever been built, but also created out of just pure passion and love for food. My first day that I arrived there, I was given a 10-pound, the Inn of Little Washington in Washington, Virginia, Chef Patrick O'Connell. He, to me, is the perfect example of what American cuisine can truly be. His undying passion for bringing that which is classic and bringing it into the modern day and presenting it in a way and in a very unpretentious, unlayered way that is constant pursuit of wanting to do better. First lesson I learned when I walked in the kitchen, that what you did yesterday has to be improved by 25%. And by constantly pushing that bar up, he's enabled to achieve every major award that could possibly be won. And I do remember the first day I walked in that kitchen, I was handed a 10-pound box of black truffles and asked, what would you do with this? And I said, well, what do you want me to do with this? And from that point on, I knew that this was probably the greatest candy store for cooks that I've ever walked into.
The place is absolutely charming. It's what is the history of this place? It's just a tin ceiling and all kinds of antiques, and it has a lot of personality.
Well, the building itself was originally built in 1910, so you've got original hardwood floors, exposed brick walls, pressed tin ceilings, and so it evolves a really comfortable class to the room without having to do much more. But my wife, Susan, she has been a fantastic decorator for the restaurant with old church windowsills and wrought iron candelabras and hanging from the ceiling. And it's trying to kind of do what we're trying to do with the whole mentality of the restaurant, is create something wonderful, but yet keep it in a very comfortable environment.
Well, actually, we're going to ask Susan for her comments. She's co-owner and major muse in all this. And we've got this wonderful story about the first day he was at the Inn at Little Washington, he encountered you, and it was love at first sight. Was that true on your side as well?
Yes, the first day that he arrived in Virginia, for me it was definitely love at first sight.
How did you know this?
I just knew in my heart.
Now, listeners, you know from this accent that she's not from Culpeper, Virginia. You are from the UK?
Yes, I am. I'm from Malvern in Worcestershire, small town, in an area similar to Virginia.
And you run the front of the house here, and I understand from your husband that he's the brawn, but you're the brains behind this whole operation.
Well, I guess so, yes.
Don't be so modest. Well, it's lovely, and you've done a grand job of this decorating. I want to ask Frank to just mention some of your specialties.
I would say the couple dishes that are truly special to me is our vanilla roasted Maine lobster with sweet corn Johnny cakes, served with a caramelized Chardonnay butter sauce. Johnny cakes I learned how to make when I was in Providence, the journey cakes. And they just sop up the caramelized Chardonnay butter sauce, and it's just like breakfast with lobster. It's become a very big hit for us. The other dish that I really am proud of is our fried egg sandwich. The fried egg sandwich was a dish that was probably the first thing I ever learned how to make. You know, being latchkey kids back, you know, growing up, my parents were always at the restaurant, so my mom taught me how to make two things. One was a fried egg sandwich. And so as I grew up, my travels, you know, I got to taste prosciutto and Parmesan Reggiano and all these fabulous flavors. And so I decided to make my best fried egg sandwich. And that's what's on the menu. It's thin ribbons of Virginia country ham, Parmesan cheese, and a garlic rub grilled crostini. Served with baby green salad and topped with a lightly fried sunny side up egg. You break the yolk, mix it together, and it just sops everything up so good.
Well, I can't wait. You have a website here, fotisrestaurant.com, fotisrestaurant.com. And do you have information on, can you reserve from there, or do you call to reserve?
You can make reservations online or just call us at the restaurant. Reservations are only necessary Friday, Saturdays.
Any other word you'd like? Is there something we've missed in this discussion that you'd like to talk about?
Well, growing up in North Dakota with farmers on one side of the family and restaurateurs on the other, it's been my constant focus to promote the use of these sustainable local farmers. We've been blessed in this area with great grounds to grow in, and the farmers constantly bringing fresh produce and from the beef to the buffalo to everything else that's been, you know, brought to our table. And just remember that food needs to come from the earth to the plate, not on the truck.
And he's articulate too, listeners. Thank you so much for talking to us. I can't wait to dive into the food.
Well, thank you both so much. It's been a real pleasure, and I do appreciate you choosing us. And this means quite a bit to both Susan and I.
It's a great choice, listeners.
Well, when we're making our rounds in Southern Virginia, we in addition to finding wonderful restaurants and being surprised by wine revelations, you tend also in this part of the country to learn a lot about history. So we're going now to talk to the owner of Grey Ghost.
Al Kellert of Grey Ghost Wines is mighty impressed with OTM's recording setup, but I can tell you that we are much more impressed with his wine setup, because it's an individual kind of thing that I think best thing to do is just ask him how he got involved in the wine business and why he had this crazy idea of starting a winery in Virginia.
Well, it started at the ripe old age of 19. Going for my degree in chemistry, I had the opportunity of working at a research lab. Head of the department was German, and he introduced me to winemaking. That was 41 years ago, and it's been going on ever since. As far as Virginia is concerned, we had heard a great deal about the potential in Virginia. We picked land that was really designed to grow fruit trees, and we knew if we could grow a fruit tree here, we could also do a vineyard.
Now, along the way, a very handsome lady called Cheryl got involved in the process too. She's sitting across the table from me. And that's not the reason I said that. I know that Al said he couldn't make these wines without her, but perhaps he can explain why.
Cheryl and I have kind of become a partner. After we got married, she agreed to participate in what was amount to, at that particular time, more of a hobby. And today, she's the one who does all of the vineyard pruning, the managing of the vineyards, and jointly making the wine.
Now, wouldn't you consider it madness to get involved in this venture? When Al first suggested you might buy this property and own a vineyard and run it as a business, what did you think?
Golly, I have to go back to our dating days when we were dating. He always said to me, I knew he was interested in business. He said, Cheryl, someday I'd like to be the president of a company. And for 20-some years, I thought he meant a company. And then he let me know he wanted his own company. And that's when it hit me that, well, this is going to really be an adventure.
But you just sat back and went along for the ride?
Yes. Yes, I did. But thoroughly, like I said earlier, we're a team. We couldn't do it without each other, and I'm thoroughly enjoying every aspect of it, and it's quite been a life ride.
So Al, tell us a little bit about the portfolio of wines that you're producing here at Grey Ghost. But before we do that, we should obviously tell our listeners where the winery got its name.
We're located at the southern end of what was known as Mosby's Confederacy. And for those of you up north, a lot of the people down south here still think we're fighting it and could still win. Mosby was known as a raider behind Union lines. Since he had a price tag on his head, he disbanded his unit rather than surrender. And the result of that is a flag that we now fly here at the winery, which was the original Mosby flag, never surrendered to the Union, so if we ever swing off to the side, we've got the flag to start it.
We should quickly note in there that this Colonel Mosby was, although he didn't call himself this, was known, and the legendary stories about him are as the
Grey Ghost.
Grey presumably from the color of the uniforms, and ghost because you seek him here, you seek him there, nobody could ever find him. Is that correct?
That's exactly the correct answer, yes.
But that certainly can't be said for the wines that are being produced here at Grey Ghost Vineyard. Strangely enough, right beside the Lee Highway, a major four-lane highway, a most unlikely place to find a vineyard, you have a portfolio of wines. Al, quickly go through those for us.
We produce a number of whites and reds. The ones that we've been tasting today are Chardonnays made in both the French style, barrel fermented, and also more of a Chablis style, stainless steel fermented. We also produce reds here, which focus on the Bordeaux grapes. Our Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignons are our two principal Bordeaux grapes that we use, along with Cabernet Franc, a grape that grows very well in Virginia, Melbach, and Petit Verdot. Probably one of the wines we're most proud of on the red side is our Ranger Reserve, which is our first Bordeaux blend containing all five of those grapes. And then we finish off with an award-winning wine, the Adieu, which is our late harvest Vidal, has become one of the most awarded wines in the U.S., and it has captured the best of the East four consecutive years. In fact, currently holds that title as no other competition of that nature is being run.
So what are you going to do for an encore, Al?
Every year we raise the bar, and our intent is to be better next year than we were this, with the idea that if our two wines were put up against each other, the new vintage will outperform the old.
And the bad news for most of you listeners is that these are wines you're going to have difficulty finding much further away from, what's the name of the town?
The Washington, D.C. metropolitan area and Richmond.
I mean, the town where you are located.
Amosville, Virginia.
So look for it if you're in the Washington, D.C. area in the very fine liquor stores that are there. I'm sure many of them carry it. Is there a way at all on your website for people to be able to find out where they might have some in supply?
Yes, our website does carry a complete listing of all of the fine wine shops and premium restaurants that do carry it, and the website would be the place to go to.
And that is, quickly, oh boy, the piece of paper stuck under the computer, but we got it out again.
It's www.greyghostvineyards.com.
And another piece of good news for both of you, I'm sure, is that you also have family that's going to continue the business.
Yes, we're really excited. Both our son and daughter have been instrumental. In fact, without them, this would have never worked. And our daughter and son-in-law have blessed us with two charming grandchildren, which now work in the vineyard at the age of 3 and 5. So we already have three generations that are ready to perform and keep this legacy going.
Well, we've had a lovely time. And if wherever the Grey Ghost is, I'm sure looking down, he's saying, this is something much more substantial than I ever achieved. So we congratulate both of you from On the Menu. And do you have a final thought?
Not really, except that it all wines have personality, and it's the personality of the winemakers, and these guys are effervescent.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
Or if you want to get in touch with us in more exciting fashion, since we're so modern, you can go to onthemenuradio.blogspot.com.
Spot.
Oh, no, blogspot.com.
You see how modern you are.
and that's no www in front of it. So join us there by all means, yeah. as well as sending us email if you'd like.
Yes, we'd like to have this be interactive, and that'll do it. You read my mind again, because I was going to say
there we go. Well, I'd like to read your mind. And in the meantime, we're deep in the heart of the wonderful Commonwealth of Virginia, and we caught up with a young couple with a fascinating adventure that combines wine, fine dining, and bicycling.
Well, we have yet another new adventure on the menu has. We were at the Foster Harris House. That's terrible. We're meeting with John and Diane McPherson, and they have a fascinating story, a fascinating company called Tour d'Epicure. Is that correct? That's hello, you two. Hello.
Hello. Oh,
thanks so much for having us.
Well, we love it. And you have so much to tell. I'm going to let you sort of steer the ship here. Who wants to start with how you ended up? First, describe the venture. What do you do?
Basically, Tour de Epicure is started off somewhat for selfish reasons because it's basically everything that we enjoy doing. We get to ride our bikes and eat fantastic food and travel in this beautiful countryside where we live here in Little Washington and Rappahannock County and drink fine wine and dine at the inn at Little Washington.
That's not half bad.
There are worse things to do. And, you know, we realize that this area doesn't actually have anything. Actually, the country really doesn't have anything quite like this.
No, I've talked to a lot of people with cycling tours and stuff. This is really special. Starting with, now you are headquartered here. This is your home base, and it's a really charming historical house. Tell us about that.
Well, the Foster Harris House has actually been a bed and breakfast for 25 years. Okay. The house is 100 years old. Mm-hmm. We took ownership of the property in 2004, and it was us coming off of corporate jobs that we were tired of, and we're actually not typical of the bed and breakfast owner, maybe getting more typical today, but we're a bit younger than your average.
You're not quaint. I mean, I used to get so fed up with that quaintness. You guys are fun.
We don't have any lace doilies at the Harris House.
No, there was not. Actually,
nothing against them, but
no.
We don't have any.
Yeah, the funny thing is when we first took over the property, we had a pretty major culling of the building and eliminated a lot of things that, you know, were pretty typical.
Yeah,
lots of doilies, lots of lace.
Things
right
that would qualify as foo-foos, as they call them.
Yeah, right.
But how old is this building?
It was built in 1905, as we understand it. Yeah.
And the great thing about this house is that it was built by the Compton family, which is a very prominent family here in Rappahannock County. And it stayed in that family for the better part of 65 years. And since then, I guess the total number of owners now is somewhere around 8.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for a 100-plus-year-old home to have 8 owners is pretty special. And that's one of the things that really attracted us to this property. The house has been really well cared for and really well maintained. And any additions that have been done to it have been done really well. They haven't, you know, done any clunky things to it. So
Mm-hmm.
So it's a perfect home base to run our tours.
John, you are a professional cyclist now. Of course, Diane cycles too, but you're on a competitive level with really developed calves.
Right. Thanks for noticing.
I'm fixated on calves since I don't have any.
I spent about 20 years racing in Southern California and retired when we took over the Foster Harris House. But, you know, the great thing about it is, you know, part of our job now is to stay fit and ride our bikes. And, you get to hop on your bicycle and introduce, 10 people to this beautiful, beautiful countryside of Rappahannock County. This, you know, a lot of people don't know about this little area, and it's about a 220-square-mile spot in Virginia at 65 miles away from Washington, D.C. And it feels like, for us, having traveled over to Europe and ridden our bikes in France and Italy, this really has kind of a feeling of Provence, because you've got your wineries, you've got your vineyards, there's rolling hills. You know, we don't have the grand mountains, you know, of the Alps or the Pyrenees in the background, but nonetheless, it's the same kind of feel. And it's so sparsely populated. Rappahannock County has about 7,500 people in that 220 square miles. So for us, out on the bikes, you could hop on your bike after breakfast and ride 25 miles to a winery and see 3 cars.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's really
special.
Now,
you also cook, but that accounts for the breakfast. But there's more to that. I mean, you have a chef that... Let's start with this. Okay, I'm going to take this tour, and I sign up.
Okay.
Okay, so I come. Diane, you kind of keep this going, the building itself and the B&B itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, we both very much do, but
So I sign up, then what happens?
Well, typically our guests arrive around 2 or 3 in the afternoon and get settled into their guest rooms, and then we do a ride. That ride is a shorter ride, one that's maybe about 14 miles total time, and it's basically for people to kind of get their sea legs, get comfortable back on the bikes, and we can sort of assess how the tour is going to go, how long it's going to take us to get to our destination the next day, and, you know, just for everyone to get to know each other. And that first evening,
And for folks that are coming that don't have bicycles and they're using our bicycles.
Yeah, what happens? You have your own bikes, too.
We do. We have a full fleet of giant brand bicycles, brand new. And
are they the really spiffy things, or are they like stable things that I could ride?
You could ride them, absolutely. Okay. But they are they're road bikes. They're super lightweight, super comfortable, efficient road bikes. So on that first day when folks check in, for folks that are using those bicycles, that's when we fit them to the bikes. We spend a little time with everybody that's using one of those bikes to make sure that they're comfortable, make sure that they're fit properly, and they know how the shifting works. And we really want people to enjoy it.
I mean, we've been at places where they've had these bike tours, and people who decided they're going to go out there should never be allowed to go anywhere on their bike. What, do you screen people for their ability to stay upright?
That's a fair question. But, when we talk to people and the information that's on our website and on our brochures, you know, we want people that are, you know, athletic and ride a bike, obviously, but you don't by any means need to be a bike racer. You just need someone that has, an aptitude for pedaling a bicycle and just a decent fitness level. The terrain out here is rolling. There's really nothing flat. So, you know, if you're not comfortable riding a bicycle 5 miles, you probably won't enjoy your riding time.
Right.
So, you know, through that, the process of us talking to the folks and when the information that they have available to them, you know, the people that come, they are from enthusiastic beginners who ride every now and again to the seasoned, you know, touring cyclist who will do 65 miles a day. But the great thing is that we have such a wide range of guests. We have folks that come and they're in their, you know, mid-20s. You know, some of our favorite guests that we've had are in their 70s, and they were by far the most inspiring people that we've had on the tour.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were just... they were like little kids. They were giddy with happiness out riding their bicycles.
Yeah.
And now, you know, limit the groups to 10, I heard.
That's
you
right.
Say.
And one of the advantages of that is that we have two guides on the road plus the van support behind. So,
which is important.
Right.
I mean, if anything happens, you've got a van there.
That's right. And John will typically ride at the front with the people who want to ride fast. And then I'll ride at the back with people who want to just take in the scenery and go at a slower pace. And, you know, sometimes we have people who after 10 miles or so say, that's enough. I had a beautiful ride. I'm satisfied with what
bus.
I've done, and I'll get on the van and ride on the van. I mean, we don't want people to anticipate riding the whole way in the van. I don't think that would be a lot of fun. But it turns out, you know, to be very low pressure. People will ride in the van when they feel comfortable.
Okay, so they're here. They're settled into the room. They are matched up to their bike. Mm-hmm. You've tested out that they're going to be happy with this. Then what happens?
Well, you know, we set out on our ride. And
that's the first ride.
Right. Yeah. So we set out on our ride. And once we come back from that ride, you know, folks go and they'll change and they'll shower and they'll relax. And then we generally we'll sit down out in the garden, out in the Adirondack chairs in the back, or sit on the deck or in the living room and have a glass of wine. And, you know, folks just will chat and get to know each other. And then that first night we'll do dinner at one of our other local restaurants. We'll dine at the Thornton River Grill, which is over in Sperryville.
Yeah, we're just there,
you,
right?
You're familiar with. You had lunch there. Tom Nash, the chef there, does a fantastic job. And it's just the great thing about that restaurant as a complement to our next dining event. The Thornton River Grill is a casual place that surprises you with the quality and the execution of the food.
Oh, sure, I agree.
Which the thing that we really love about the tour is that when people come out here, they have a certain expectation. You know, you're coming out to the country, they're going to ride, they're going to have lunch, and they're going to have a meal. And for folks that know about the Inn at Little Washington, they know what that's going to be like. But they don't, they kind of expect the other aspects of it to be pretty typical of what another tour would be. So we like to surprise them with the food and the wine and the beauty of the place. So the Thornton River Grill works perfect. The food is wonderful. You'll see a nice mix of locals there as well as, you know, visitors to the area. And we sit down there, a table of 12. Diane and I generally go to dinner on each evening. And, you know, it's like at that point, it has usually already started to meld into kind of a family at that point. It's amazing how quick, you know, people know each other because we're in a, you know, they come from the D.C. area or Baltimore, and yeah, someone knows someone or someone works for a company, mm-hmm, and before you know it, the conversation flows. A couple glasses of wine later and everyone's having, mm-hmm, a fantastic time.
And then they come back, they go to bed, and then the next day you really throw a longer tour at them.
That's right.
And then after the wonderful breakfast, of course.
Yeah, we do. You know, the food is a big part of the Foster Harris House here too. So we spend a fair bit of time in the morning.
Well, we should also say that these tours are about food first and then wine and then cycling in that order. Mm-hmm. So in the morning, my husband is a wonderful cook and he does a 4-course breakfast in the morning, and people always say that they don't think they're going to be able to eat that, but somehow they come down to breakfast and they do. And then after breakfast, everybody gets ready to go on our longer ride, and that ride takes us to a local vineyard. Some days we go to Rappahannock Cellars, which is about the scenic route we take is about 24 miles to get there. And again, mm-hmm, it's rolling, so mm-hmm, it's fairly challenging to go. And when we get there, we have a lunch that is catered, it's not your bologna sandwich lunch that you might sometimes get on a sort of an athletic adventure. We have a full 3-4-course catered lunch at our destination, and the chef comes on site to prepare it. Mm-hmm. Todd, he does a wonderful job. Mm-hmm. And the people again say that they don't think that they'll be able to ride after such a meal, but they, surprisingly, after a glass of wine or two, most people, they after their wine and then the tour of the wine, the winery, they feel ready to go and get back on their bikes.
Yeah, well, my favorite thing, and John said, is that actually, with all the exercise you get from cycling, you can eat almost anything you want.
That's the beauty of it, absolutely.
Yeah, guilt-free eating.
Yeah. Did you want to say something, Rabideau? How do people hook up with this? How many of these do you do, and how long in advance do people have to reserve, and how do they go around doing that?
You know, the website will have all of the dates that will be available.
Okay.
This year we only have a couple of dates left. We generally do our tours from April, middle of April through the first week in November. And generally we'll do two tours a month. There'll be a midweek tour and then a weekend tour. And those will be three-day tours. You'll start on a Tuesday, ride Tuesday, Wednesday, and check out on Thursday.
And what do you do, Diane, after season? I mean, do you still run the B&B?
We do. We are, because the Inn at Little Washington is such a draw for this area, we do business year-round.
Oh, that's good.
Very strong business year-round.
We're pretty much booked every weekend of every month.
That's right.
How about your website so everybody knows?
Right. Well, the tour website is www.tourdeepicure.com, and I'm going to spell that, TOURDEPICURE.com.
You also have an 800 number.
And the 800 number is 800-874-1153.
Right. And you implied there was another website?
Right. If you wanted to visit the Foster Harris House or just look at the property that you stay at when you're on a tour, it's just www.fosterharris.com. And that's all one, as if it's all one word.
Mm-hmm. And then am I right, and we've alluded to this, but you finish each group, each tour, with a dinner at the Inn at Little Washington.
That's right.
Now that's really special. Oh, I didn't think I was doing that. Peter tells me I'm banging the table. I'm getting excited about this.
We are too. Why don't you tell them a little bit about dinner at the
This is definitely the best part of our cycling tours, especially for people who have never been introduced to the Inn at Little Washington before. The Saturday's ride is fairly long. It's 25 miles to our winery, and then for folks that ride afterwards, it's another, 10 to 25 miles again. So, people have put in a good day, and they definitely have earned their dinner. And once they're back here at the Foster Harris House, and they sit and relax for a little while and play with Stella out in the backyard. And
Stella?
Stella's our dog. We have a yellow lab, and she is always there to greet guests with a slobbery toy and play tug-of-war out in the backyard. Uh-huh. But we generally come down, and everyone collects in the living room, and we'll have a glass of champagne to toast our riding, and everyone's accomplishments, and then we make the long block and a half walk up the streets to the Inn at Little Washington for dinner. For anyone that's been to the Inn, they know what the experience is like, but it's by far one of the most elaborate and lavish and
hospitable
and comfortable dining experiences you'd ever have. And the Inn treats everyone, just spectacularly, but we're there a lot, and they take wonderful, wonderful care of us. So we'll sit down to dinner at the Inn, and we'll be there for, 3.5 hours. And we'll have, multiple courses at the Inn. And one thing we failed to mention, which is incredibly important, the tour price is inclusive of every meal, all your accommodations, all of your support, bicycles, and dinner at the Inn at Little Washington, and all of the wine throughout the weekend.
And I was going to ask that nasty little question. What is the price range for these tours?
The price range is about, it starts at $7.99 a person for a midweek tour, up to $11.99 for the biggest room on a weekend tour. So that's the range.
Okay, well, I'm getting signals from our little producer over here to say that we're going to have to say goodbye. We've loved meeting you, and I think it's very exciting.
One of the reasons we have to say goodbye is that somebody already rang the doorbell and said, can we check in yet?
That's right.
So there's a whole tour of people expected, so we have to respect their requirement to be able to get back to business. So,
thank you.
But it's been just a pleasure. This is a delightful place. It's a lovely little town. And the Inn at Little Washington is an experience that Anne and Peter have had. So it's one of the best you'll ever enjoy in the whole world.
Well, thank you both again.
No, thank you. We hope you can come back and ride with us sometime.
Well, yes, once my broken foot is healed.
Right. Right.
Once you're all healed up. But, of course, you could always eat and drink with a broken foot. So that's
true.
Great.
All right, you guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
And once again, it's break time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We are now in a very charming spot called Barbersville at an outstanding restaurant with great wines. And let's just listen to our interviews.
Well, hold on a second. Before we do that,
okay.
Remember that our subject was really Virginia Wine Month, so wines are featured as well as fine dining, of course. This property, the Barbersville Vineyards, can be credited really with starting the whole modern development of winemaking in Virginia in the last 30 years, because an Italian winemaker decided to come over and buy a property in Virginia and start the whole process off. As a result of his efforts, there's a splendid vineyard, and we're going to talk to the winemaker from there, who, curiously enough, also happens to be Italian as well.
That's not too curious.
But first up, a really extraordinarily talented and very experienced chef, Melissa Close, who cooked a magnificent meal for us.
I have not an unusual, but a very, very prized position here, having just eaten this wonderful meal. I can rave, and nobody's going to question it, because there are four of us sitting around that all had eaten this wonderful menu and all this wonderful food put together by Melissa Crowthers Close. Is that your, say your middle name or your maiden?
Crowther.
Crowther, which we've established with my husband as being very English. Where did you start? You were from Alabama. Tell us just briefly your history, how you ended up here in this place in Virginia.
Well, I it's all my life. I started at the age of 15 working at a subpar fast food type restaurant, but it got my foot in the door. I eventually, when I went off to college, I worked at a full-service restaurant and got interested in Italian cuisine and worked in Birmingham at a place called Bottega for Frank Stitt, and put myself through college to be a school teacher, high school teacher, and graduated with my master's and realized I was a much better cook than a school teacher. So I went back to culinary school and went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont. And I did my first internship here in Charlottesville, Virginia at Clifton Inn with a gentleman named Craig Hartman, who I understand you're going to be interviewing tonight at Keswick Inn. I did my second internship at Rose Pistola in San Francisco, got back into Italian food at that point, and then went to work for Craig again in Colorado at the Cliff House at Pikes Peak and worked for him about 2 years. And he's good friends with Luca, our winemaker. And found out he needed an executive chef and pushed me into that direction. And that was 7.5 years ago. So I've been here ever since.
Well, now, listeners, the name of the restaurant is Palladio, which is an obvious reference to a major Italian art, which I won't get into details of it, but it apparently relates to the fact that Thomas Jefferson, who was a big proponent of Palladian architecture, helped design the original estate here at the Barbersville Vineyard. And, of course, with your Italian winemaker and your Italian-style wines, your cooking fits in very well. And, I mean, Peter and I eat Italian food all over Italy, and your style is just perfect, light, and it's northern, right?
Yes, we primarily focus on northern Italian cuisine. Italian cuisine was real easy for me to understand and get behind by growing up in the South in Alabama. You get used to open up your back door and go to your garden and cook what's in season. And it's a very similar philosophy to Italian cooking. There's definitely differences in what you do with it after that. But all in all, the base philosophy of Southern cuisine here in the States is very similar to Italians. And it's simply taking what's in season, what's the best flavor, doing the least amount to it, and putting it on the plate. And growing up, my mother was born and raised in Mobile, too. I'm sure I think her mother was, too. So I'm very Southern Belle and grew up on home cooking. So it was an easy transition for me. And luckily, the Zonin family that owns us allows us to close the restaurant for the whole month of January and sends myself and my sous chef to Italy for 2 weeks to work in some of the best restaurants in Italy. So a lot of these recipes and a lot of the techniques I've actually learned under some great chefs in Italy, and I bring back here to the States.
Can you share with us some of the chefs you've worked with in Italy?
I'm probably going to butcher names of restaurants and regions. Being the Southern girl, I don't speak Italian very well. One of my favorite restaurants we worked at was in the Valtellina region, just south of Switzerland, a place called La Terna Verde, the Tenola brothers. I believe it's a 2-Michelin-star restaurant, and they just took us in as part of their family and for 10 days taught us everything they know. We've been to a place called Alpino and just outside of Milan, and he's known all over Italy for making risotto. That was my first stage over there, and so learned the right way to make risotto, and you now and teach all my employees the same way. Been all over.
Are you the school where you have to stir?
Yes and no. You don't have to stir as much, I think, as a lot of people think. But yes, you stir it quite a bit, but you don't have to stand right over it. I think if we had to do that, we'd have a cook that did nothing but make risotto.
I know restaurants where that happens, but anyhow, any other, others you'd like to mention of Italian chefs you've worked for or restaurants you've worked at?
I think one place, most places we work are all really traditional restaurants, but one restaurant where Alessandro, our maitre d', grew up in just outside of Bergamo, Assisotto, restaurant called La Laconda, and his place was very interesting because he takes traditional flavors and combinations and does them a little more nouveau, but not fusion, not that kind of nouveau, but it was just something a little more along what we do of taking that classic combination of tomato and basil and putting it together in a new way. And that was probably one of my second favorite restaurant to work in Italy.
Well, one of the things I noticed that you do that's creativa, they say, is your presentations are just knock your socks off.
Well, thank you. You know, it's hard in the U.S., I think, for a diner that's never been to Europe to understand how simple food can be, even in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant that's, you know, very expensive. It's still very simple plating. And a lot of times if you get a steak, what you get is a steak with great olive oil on it and maybe a little bit of fresh arugula. And I know American diners wouldn't quite understand that, so we try to take it a little bit more in the American fine dining style. And I have got great cooks in the kitchen. We're all trained and worked at fabulous restaurants across the country. So we kind of bring in all that, you know, simplistic plating still. You know, there's still less than 5 ingredients on most of my plates, but just to kind of refine it a little bit and make it a little more accessible to the American fine diner.
But that doesn't mean they're not startling. Tell the listeners about my wonderful fish.
Currently we're running it's grouper currently, and we wrap it in a shredded phyllo, and we put it in a deep fryer so the phyllo ends up kind of puffing out, so it makes it look almost like a sea anemone in a way, and it gives you a nice texture, and the fish stays really moist inside of it, and served it with a really nice yellow tomato gazpacho, so you've got that really nice, smooth, cold texture of the gazpacho, but the crispy, hot texture of the fish and the phyllo.
The other dishes, what were you particularly pleased with? I mean, we liked all of them. We particularly liked the stuffed zucchini blossom, stuffed with.
We stuffed it with a scallop mousse.
I never, ever had that.
This is actually one of my sous chef's creations, and just the sweetness and creaminess of the scallop mousse with the slight, you know, kind of that garden fresh flavor of a squash blossom just really balances each other out, and do it with a really beautiful silky corn puree. I think one of my favorite dishes we're doing right now, talking about the plating and, you know, bringing in classic combinations but in a new way, we're doing a twist on the prosciutto and melon, which you'll see in every single restaurant in Italy.
Love.
We've taken 3 different types of melons. We did a honeydew sorbet, just cantaloupe that's nice and fresh and raw. And then we do a braised watermelon, which we braise in our rosé wine. And it's a technique I learned from another chef down in Atlanta. And it just turns into this great texture. It almost seems like raw tuna in the color and the texture it gets. But that way we're still doing the classic prosciutto and melon, but doing it in a new inventive way, but not stepping so far out of the box that we lose the tradition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really sums up a lot about the quality of your food. That was an extraordinary dish. Now, Peter's poking me.
No, I was only poking you because I wanted to mention the fresh corn on top of the risotto. It was just such a delicious surprise.
Do you want to, I mean, I don't know what you're supposed to say about that, but I liked it too.
Well, it's a nice combination because, you know, we're doing a risotto with saffron and fresh corn with some fried frog legs on top, and do a cornmeal crust on the frog legs. But I think the sweetness of the corn, and, you know, saffron's got a sweetness, but it's a bittersweet, and there's just a really nice textural difference. I really try on all my plates to kind of hit all the part, you know, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, along with soft and crunchy and, you know, textural things, and try to keep the palate happy and not get it boring anywhere along the menu. And it's tough to do because, you know, most people get all 4 courses, and you want it to be light enough at the first course that when they get to the main course, they still have room and they don't go home completely stuffed, that palate alive the whole way through.
Well, we didn't get through the dolce, the desserts, because we have to go yet to another restaurant to do that. And I wanted to mention that listeners who were crazy about cheeses, they have a fabulous list of cheeses. And you can choose up to 5 to create your own cheese plate, which next time we will do. And I want to add that, Melissa, you are an extraordinary cook, and this is an extraordinary place to come. Are you open dinner and lunch, or lunch? We were here for lunch, so your lunch and dinner. When? How many days?
It's actually one of the most fabulous restaurant schedules. We do lunch Wednesday through Sunday and dinner Friday and Saturday only. And that way, it's always the same staff. I haven't written a schedule in 7.5 years, but you know, we talk sometimes about expanding that, but we would have to bring in other staff members, and it would be somebody, two different people working the same station, and the consistency might be different. And one thing we pride ourselves on, if you come in here 2 months from now, it's going to be the same type of meal you had today.
We loved it. And you have an email? I mean, a website.
Yes, we do. We have, you can either go to PalladioRestaurant.com or BarbersvilleWines.com, and they'll both take you to both sites.
We loved it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
And now on to Peter's interview with the winemaker.
On the Menu is going to have to do this interview fairly quickly because our guest, Luca Paschina, is not only the best winemaker in Orange County, Virginia, he's also a soccer coach, and he's wearing number 7, and he's heading off soon to coach the Little Azzurri of Orange County, Orange County United. Luca, welcome to On the Menu.
Well, thank you for having me here.
And this is not exactly a traditional step in winemaking to come from the region where you came from. We know your home is Alba in the Piemonte region, but you are in a Piemonte region of a different name. But what got you here in the first place?
Well, I was in the late 80s just starting to work as a consultant for grape growing and winemaking. Apparently, somebody told Mr. Zonin, which is the owner of the estate, about my availability, and he was just looking for, at that time, for a young winemaker available to come to in the Piedmont of Virginia and help him introduce new varieties and produce new wines here in Virginia.
So when you came, you called it the Piemonte, and the people in Virginia said, "What's that?" We call it the Piedmont. Don't you know how to speak Virginian?
Right. It was interesting to learn that there was a similarity from the Piedmont and Piemonte, which means nothing else but at the foot of the hills. Piemont is from French. And there are a lot of similarities here in the landscape, and also there is also a very nice history here and culture that's somewhat quite European. And so I felt somewhat at home, even if it's far away.
And Luca, that was how many years ago?
That was in 1990, so I guess 18.
Wow, that's a long time. Did you ever expect when you first got here that you would stay this long?
I had no idea how long I was going to stay, but I at first really was very interested in staying for a long term, whatever the long term means. Now I guess this is home, and I go in Italy.
Is that right? So you go to Italy to visit, and when you go back, you go to your home region.
I always travel a little bit through Piemonte for sure, and then I really like and enjoy going to Tuscany and Sicily as well. And lately, I discovered Sardinia, which is actually where my grandfather is from. So that's beautiful too.
Too hard to say. Go over the range of wines because it seems like you grow almost every grape in captivity here in Virginia. But what are some of the grape varieties that you really like that have done well here?
Yeah, in the white segment, we really have seen that we have noticed great results on Pinot Grigio and Viognier. And in the red side, the classic Bordeaux varietals, the Merlot, the Cabernet Sauvignon, Franc, they do extremely well. And we have a little bit later on discovered that actually Nebbiolo does thrive extremely well, which is the most important grape of Italy, or if not, at least in the north of Italy, in Piemonte specifically.
There's a guy there. You will get a little argument from the guys who print Otto Pucciano to say Nebbiolo is the most famous grape in Italy, but we can't disagree with you, and we sampled some, and we would have to say it really does very well. Now, have you actually taken any back to Alba and said, try this, guys?
Yeah, actually, I participated at the Nebbiolo Symposium 2 years ago in Alba, and there were producers invited from outside of Italy that grow Nebbiolo. So there were from Australia, from South Africa, California, Oregon, Virginia. And a lot of Italian winemakers, upon tasting the selection, they told me that the one from Virginia was the best one outside of Italy. And then I argued a little bit with the winemaker because he told me that my Nebbiolo didn't taste like his Nebbiolo from Italy. And I told him, well, it's not that mine doesn't taste like yours. It's the other way around. It's yours doesn't taste like mine.
Now, was it actually a blind tasting or did they know?
They knew what they were tasting. But indeed, our Nebbiolo did extremely well. And not only there in Italy, but several wine critics in the U.S. have declare that it's the best Nebbiolo that is outside of Italy.
We understand that our old friend, the grape radio guy, was here.
and he thought it was pretty serious wine.
Yes, he did. He did. And the guy really knows. He goes around, tastes a lot of wines from many regions. And that's also what draws most times critics to Virginia. It's because they heard that there are great wines here. And when they come, they really discover it and realize that it is true.
We said exactly the same thing when we tasted it. We said this is serious wine. But the flagship wine is an eight-sided wine. Tell us about Octagon.
Well, yeah, Octagon means exactly, you know, that it's a geometrical figure with eight facets. Although it's a blend of Bordeaux varietals, predominantly Merlot, he's dedicated the word Octagon to actually to the feature that Jefferson had in all his buildings that he drew, including one that is on our farm. As Jefferson, most people know, was a great lover of Italian and French wines in particular, he tried to grow grapes here in the early 1800s. He planted up to 22 different varieties in 1807 in Monticello. Never was able to produce a bottle of wine. So in a way, this wine is now vindicating the fact that he really wanted to do it. And so it's dedicated to him in a way.
But the secret is being able to graft whatever vine you want onto a rootstock, correct?
Right. Back in 1800, they didn't know about the existence of this disease that is present here in the wilderness. It's called phylloxera. So whenever they planted European grapes, they would have never survived long enough to produce a crop. And that's the same disease that then was brought to Europe and devastated European viticulture. So today we're grafting, well, American rootstock underground in the root system, on which we graft all the different varieties of grapes from Europe that we like.
Now, what's next? You're 18 years, but I'm sure you haven't stopped inventing what you're going to do next. So give our listeners a scoop as to what you think might be coming next from Barbersville.
Well, what's coming next is I'm more like the chef that I'm not looking at surprising people every year with new composition and new odd flavors. I'm becoming more and more traditionalist in the way I make wine. So what's new is just more new vintages, more great vintages. The only little thing that we're experimenting with right now is with Viognier, which we have seen that some of our bottling are going beyond the 7-8 year of aging and still very beautiful. So maybe there is something new there still to be unseen. But overall, I believe that we have found what works. I want to stick to it and just make it better.
Well, that sounds like a great thing for the future. And you're going to stay here? You're here for the duration?
I have no plans to go back to Italy for sure. No plans to go anywhere else. I really enjoy this place. I dedicate a lot of years here and created a great family here at the vineyard. And I want to enjoy it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us. And what's the last word we say? Va Azzurri?
Forza Azzurri.
And even though the result in the Olympics was not quite what everybody would have liked.
Oh yeah, the Olympic, they don't count. That's okay. They just it's a farce of soccer there.
It's a nice way. So since we lost, it must be a farce. Thank you so much for talking to us. After Orange United.
Thank you.
Well, while we're basking at how much fun and good food we had there, we can look ahead to next week when we will have additional interviews with all our new friends in Southern Virginia, and also a very special treat since we have an interview with Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine.
So she'll be sure to tune in, same time, same place, and we'll look forward to talking to you then.
Bye-bye.